Nick Schinkel, the director of the West Lafayette Public Library, reviews Sarah Wheeler's second book, The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. Wheeler is the author of the best-selling book, Terra Incognita, Travels in Antarctica. In this book, she journeys to the opposite pole to create a definitive picture of life on the fringes. Nick Schinkel begins his review by reading from the book.
In the hallway of an apartment block toward the northern edge of town, a man was tucking a baby into a carriage. The handlebar had a circular holder for a baby's bottle or, in this case, paternal beer. The man, short and flat-faced, like all ethnic people of the Russian Arctic, threw out his chest and swigged hard before sallying into the street. In an office off the hallway, posters advertised Bering Sea Biodiversity, and on a bank of desks, miniature Chukotka flags fluttered gaily from jam jars when a breeze sneaked in through the ill-fitting windows. Edouard de Jour was preoccupied with negotiations for an increased whale quota. Quote, "The quota for the whole of Chukotka is 5 bowheads and 135 gray whales," he explained as we drank bitter coffee brewed on a portable gas burner. "Bowheads are difficult to harvest here because they really swim through Chukchi waters but when the surface is frozen, whereas they reach Barrow in Alaska in the spring, so our neighbors there can pick them off from floes. Alaskan Inuit don't hunt grays, but it doesn't mean that those of us west of the Bering Strait might as well switch to gray whales." As president of the Chukotka Marine Mammal Hunters Association, de Jour instinctively recognized the role the bowhead played in native Chukchi communities, economically and psychologically. That's an opening to a chapter entitled No Cows, the Arctic in Asian Russia from The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle. Today's book is magnetic in more ways than one, taking us into a region that has drawn explorers from the much warmer southern climes to its cold depths as they search for fame, fortune, and answers to their curiosity, as author Sarah Wheeler can well attest, as she herself has traveled the Arctic regions of the world to answer her own questions. As Booklist stated, quote, "Wheeler's theme is heroic individual struggle, such as pioneering polar aviation, heroism of the Norwegian resistance during World War II, and life in the Soviet gulag." Two, as we know, the North Pole area is magnetic as a geophysical property. And I'll suggest that the magnetic North has local appeal as well, with all the Purdue research into the Arctic regions that has been happening for a number of years now. And finally, and best of all, I'll recommend Magnetic North to you because of the beauty and the quiet passion of Wheeler's prose. Page after page unfolds with as much mystery and suspense as a good novel, with as much wonder as a coffee table exposé book, and as many interesting natural and biographical anecdotes as the best travel writing can offer. This is truly a book that blends science, history, and biography into a delightful, readable mix, as Publishers Weekly wrote, quote, "Fantastic. Readers are whisked away on an incredible, multifaceted tour of a region still unknown. This fact-filled narrative is nearly impossible to put down." I certainly agree. Well, we begin our travels with Sarah Wheeler in the Arctic worlds of Russia, where we began this review, which in addition to being the home to native peoples who still hunt whales, was also the destination of thousands of political exiles from the time of Lenin in the 1920s forward, the famed Soviet gulag. Next, we visit the Alaskan Arctic and run with Wheeler along the Dalton Road, the fabled Alaskan oil pipeline sashaying beside it, as she eloquently writes. And along the way, read not only about the oil pipeline, but learn what it means to be Alaskan, as well as learning about the native peoples who have called this land home for thousands of years. Traveling east, we find Wheeler sojourning in Iqaluit, the new capital of Canada's vast native lands of that nation's far north. A land only recently of interest to Western cultures, it was a key focus of Allied military surveillance during World War II, as Allied radar, planes, and warships worked to keep Nazi U-boats out of this vast northern area, and more recently, the location of the Dew Line, or the early warning area to warn of possible nuclear attack from Russia. And always there is Wheeler's sharp descriptive writing of this setting of this far northern world. As she writes about this area in northern Canada, sharp, heavy rain squalls unfurled across the tundra, quickly as fog, painting the landscape gray. The horizon dissolved, and the world turned to a miasma of opaque vapor. When the rain cloud rolled back, the distant rocks shone as though they had been varnished. If that happened in the early morning, our hopes of getting out on a traverse rose, like milk to the boil. But the rain always came back. On my 10th day, it pinned us in camp. Pilots went off to read what they referred to as heli porn. This turned out to be a stack of magazines called Vertical. The scientists retaliated with geoporn, magazines about hammers, drills, screws, and shafts. We mostly hung out in the office tent. Doug put his head out the door during a lull, withdrew it again, stood up, and announced, "Here's the next bit of crud coming in." He was the most phlegmatic, as he had so many seasons under his belt. Shutdown conditions were an integral part of the Arctic experience. After a week, I had the measure of the weather. The temperature ricocheted between 41 degrees Fahrenheit and, exceptionally, 70 degrees. More significant, the pendulum swung between freezing wind and warmish calm, inhabited by dark billions of mosquitoes. For a few heavenly moments every day, the pendulum looped through the midway point, and there were no bugs, no lacerating wind. But you couldn't really enjoy the interlude because you knew what was coming next. I can't say it was ruinously grim, because I enjoyed those weeks in camp. The geologist's absorption of the landscape was infectious, and even the weather had a gruesomely satisfying rhythm. But in comparison with the luminous dry air of the Brooks Range in Alaska, say, it was, well, it just wasn't very pleasant on Southampton Island. We travel next to the oddly named giant island of Greenland, further east to visit the Spitsbergen Islands, a rocky series of islands far in the north with no native peoples. And then on to the far north of Scandinavia, where Norway, Sweden, and Finland converge. We conclude with a return to the Russian far north, where Wheeler ends her travelogue with these chapter-opening thoughts. At the end, I returned to Russia, where I had started, lured northwest by the turrets and domes on a 500-ruble note. Set among the fabled White Sea whitecaps, the Solvaki Monastery, according to generations of true believers, cradles the national soul. Beached in a polar hinterland more than 6,000 miles from the Chukchi and their antlered herds, the medieval monastery represents the endurance of hope and faith and the survival of the human spirit against what once seemed like insuperable odds. As a gulag system emerged from the chaos of the 20s, Solvaki's model of forced labor multiplied across the USSR. As Solzhenitsyn wrote, from the one cancer cell on that White Sea outpost, a tumor spread all over Russia. The monks of the monastery have returned to chant, perhaps for the forgiveness of others. Just as dignified integrity outlasted cultural destruction among the Inuit, a sense of quiet redemption lived on among the boneyards of Stalin's White Sea camp. It was a good place to end. Wheeler has, as we just heard, a marvelous capacity for moving seamlessly from the horrors visited upon native peoples of the North by both well-meaning and careless Western visitors. And in the next breath, writes of the wonder-filled literature and art that this same northern landscape has inspired. Writing about an explorer in that northernmost area of Canada, she gives us this anecdote about a number of great English writers and one particular explorer named Hearn. When he returned to England from Canada, Hearn met Coleridge, who later cited the older man's anecdotes as an influence on his unfinished ballad, The Three Graves. Coleridge said he wanted to show that the witchcraft of the Dene, the native peoples, the workings of their imagination, in other words, was not peculiar to savage or barbarous tribes. And in the ballad, Coleridge changed Hearn's Dene people to English ones. Some critics think Hearn was a model for the Ancient Mariner. He said that as a young man, he had been inspired by the story of the fictional Robinson Crusoe. Alexander Selkirk, the real-life Crusoe, inspired Defoe. Defoe inspired Hearn. Hearn inspired Coleridge. And so it goes. In the very same chapter, she talks a little bit later about the fellow who is often considered to be Canada's greatest writer, Farley Mowat. And then later in the chapter on Greenland, she provides this fascinating anecdote. Before the bombers came, the northwest of Greenland had already found a man to express its bleak landscapes in paint. Greenland discovered its Gauguin in Rockwell Kent, the early American modernist who saw his Tahiti in the starlit winters of Igdolorisit. Kent, or Kinti, as he was known to the Greenlandic neighbors, twice spent a year in Greenland, in flight, as he said, from the chaos of 1930s America. Often he camped out on the sea ice to work for days at a stretch. Quote, in Greenland one discovers, as if for the first time, he wrote, what beauty is. God must forgive me that I tried to paint it, end quote. The stylized portraits that emerged, in the form of woodcuts or pencil drawings, depict broad-chested, heroic figures with high cheekbones and sealskin camic that came to a point at the toes. In fact, the graphic art tradition in which Kent worked was quite English. One thinks of Hogarth and Blake. His superb skills as a draftsman had already brought him worldwide fame as a book illustrator. At one stage, he was the most popular artist in America. But post-war abstract expressionism left no room for figurative and landscape compositions. More seriously, Kent's outspoken leftist beliefs led to trouble in the McCarthyist 50s. Although he never joined the Communist Party, the State Department revoked his passport. Fortunately, many paintings had already gone to market. Kent's stock is high again. In 2003, Sotheby's in New York sold Blue Day, Greenland, for $232,000. So perhaps his message about the far north wasn't too late after all. Well, this ebb and flow of human experience that she recounts as anecdotes and part of her travel diary allows the reader to experience the highs and lows of these cold, sometime pristine lands and experience so many other books about the Arctic touch on but fail to offer. By the way, if Sarah Wheeler's name sounds familiar, perhaps it is because of her best-selling travel book from about a decade ago, which focused on Antarctica. It is entitled Terra Incognita, and it too is worth a look. As I mentioned, Wheeler concludes her rich travel tale of the far north where she began, on the Arctic shores of Russia, and that is where we'll close as well. She begins that chapter where she was talking about the monastery in North Russia with this quote from Alexander Solzhenitsyn and his Gulag Archipelago. The glaciers came and went. The granite boulders littered the shores of the lakes. The lakes froze during Solovaki winter nights. The sea howled under the wind and was covered with an icy sludge and in places froze. The northern lights blazed across half the sky, and it grew bright once again and warm once again. And the fir trees grew and thickened, and the birds cackled and called, and the young deer trumpeted. And the planets circled through all world history, and kingdoms fell and rose. And here there were still no beasts of prey and no human being. Returning to her own experiences, Wheeler writes, the white sea wind picked up speed, and out on deck, salty spray sent the others hurrying into the cabin. A mist had fallen over the distant domes. What had the first fishermen made of it as they piloted their flimsy craft across this water centuries before Solzhenitsyn? Did they lay out the stones for their labyrinth spirals as a way of reaching towards some unobtainable, transcendental truth? Or did the stones mark the edges of a Bronze Age rubbish dump? The trawler I was on chugged to the coast. Over oil wells, speculators had not yet sunk. Either way, The mossy whorls revealed the human spirit at work, stretching back across oceans of time. They were manifestations of the human need to make order. It was better not to know. And so ends The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle, by author Sarah Wheeler. It's a fantastic read about an area few of us probably have visited, but about which many of us want to know more. And it's available at all of our fine libraries, including the West Lafayette Public Library.
Nick Schinkel is the director of the West Lafayette Public Library, and he's reviewed Sarah Wheeler's newest book, The Magnetic North, Notes from the Arctic Circle.